Okay, so this is Bio 241. It's November 25th. Just got done with the last test. And we have a test coming up very shortly in here because it's Thanksgiving week. So there's only one lecture this week. Next week there are two lectures. And then final start the following week on Tuesday. So we won't have any lectures the following week. 2 weeks after Thanksgiving, we won't have a lecture. So we only have three more lectures left. So the chapters that are going to be on the test, I'm going to try and get as many as possible on the test. So probably 13 and 14, maybe a little bit of 15, I'm not sure. Okay, so you have to come back, but for sure everything in cardiovascular system. All right, so we got to get started on 13. And 13 involves a lot of review from anatomy, so I'm not going to review anatomy for you. So if you need to go back and review that, you have to do that on your own. Like for instance, how many chambers does a heart have?
Four.
How many valves does a heart have?
Four.
That's right. You should just say four and four, okay, because it's exactly equal. And then of course you got to go back in and fill in where those valves are and all that kind of stuff. But if you got some questions when we get to that, I'll try to answer them quickly. All right, so let's talk about the functions of the circulatory system, including blood. All right, so what kind of tissue is blood, for instance? What kind of tissue? Whoop. It's connective tissue. That's right. Remember, there are four kinds of tissues in the body: epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. And blood is a connective tissue, so it connects all the different parts of your body together. It's an interesting kind of connective tissue. Why is it kind of a different and interesting connective tissue? Because it's liquid, it's a fluid. Yeah, it flows through your body because it's a liquid. So that's why it's pretty important. So the cardiovascular system, including the blood, is important because it transports gases around, respiratory gases, oxygen from the lungs to your tissues, and in the tissues it picks up waste products, byproducts of respiration, namely CO2, and you're familiar with all those biochemical pathways. It carries CO2 back to the lungs and you expel or excrete carbon dioxide in the lungs. The cardiovascular system also delivers nutrients everywhere in your body through your cells. Like, give me an example of an important nutrient that your cells need. Oxygen, but I kind of already covered that in terms of respiratory gases. So something besides oxygen and CO2.
Calcium?
Yeah, calcium's important for lots of stuff. We see it's important for synaptic transmission, muscle contraction, and also it's just a structural component of bone. We're going to see another important reason today for calcium in your blood. But what's another important nutrient? Energy nutrient. Okay, yeah. ATP is an important energy nutrient, but it's not really carried by the blood because it is made by all cells. They have a special organelle that makes ATP for them. What's that organelle? Yeah, all cells have mitochondria that make ATP for them. But how do these cells make ATP? They need an energy molecule. I think somebody said it, but I'm not quite sure. Glucose. Is glucose carried in the blood? You think? Yes, okay, because as a matter of fact, you should know a couple of hormones that are important for regulating glucose in the blood. What are important hormones? The two. Insulin and glucagon, and of course others play roles, like epinephrine and all that kind of stuff. So think of glucose when we say delivery of nutrients and hormones. Give me a name of a hormone that's carried in. Are all hormones carried in the blood? You're taught to say no to the question that says, in every case, is it true? You're taught to say no. But in this case, you have to say yeah, because that's what a definition of a hormone is. It's carried by the blood someplace to a target tissue to elicit a response. All right, so hormones are carried by the blood. Waste product removal. Breakdown product of proteins is a nitrogen group, right? So urea is transported to the kidneys, and the kidneys put it in urine, and you eliminate it from your body. Another important function of the blood is temperature regulation. So if you take your temperature, if you're healthy, you're going to notice that it's 98.6 pretty much all the time. It's going to vary a little bit unless you're sick, but certain parts of your body actually heat up when they're being used. Give me an example of maybe some part of your body that's going to heat up when it's used. Yeah. When you're using this part of your body temperature increases. What happens when your body temperature increases? You start to sweat. So what kind of organs, when you use them, makes you sweat? And somebody said muscles. Absolutely. So when muscles contract, one of the byproducts of that reaction is it increases heat, gets hotter. All right. The blood is also important for immune function. It helps fight disease. It kills bacteria, viruses, fungi, other kinds of parasites in your body if you have a pathogen inside you. And another important function of the blood is, since it is a fluid, when you damage a blood vessel, guess what happens to it? It clots. Yeah, but before it clots, what happens? When you damage a blood vessel. Oh, we need to do an experiment. Give me a scalpel. What's going to happen? Yeah, this fluid is just going to run right out of your body. So another important function of blood is to stop blood loss or clotting. Okay, so there are mechanisms in blood that... 13. So the cessation of bleeding, we call that hemostasis, maintaining blood volume. That's another important function. So we're going to learn about some of these things. All right, so components of the circulatory system include the cardiovascular system, as well as the lymphatic system. The heart pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. Blood vessels carry blood to and from the heart. Okay, so what's the definition of an artery? This is just anatomy. What's an artery do? That's right, carries blood away from the heart. A vein carries blood to the heart. Okay, and what do you have in between an artery and a vein? You have capillaries. What's special about a capillary? Because that's the site where exchange can take place. And you should probably have a pretty good idea why exchange can happen in a capillary. Can it happen in an artery or a vein? You're shaking your head no. I agree with you. Why can exchange take place in a capillary but not an artery or a vein? Okay. Well, open up that anatomy book, because if you look at the layers of blood vessels, you'll see that arteries and veins are thick. They have many layers. They got connective tissue, elastic tissue, muscle layers, a couple kinds of muscle layers, and then the endothelium that lines that tube. So arteries and veins are way too thick to allow for diffusion. But a capillary has one really thin layer, and that's the endothelium. It's just a simple squamous epithelium, and material can diffuse through that. Moreover, there are spaces between the cells of that endothelium that allow for fluid and other things to diffuse very readily through a capillary. Okay, the other thing that you should know about these different kinds of vessels is, well, capillaries are specialized for exchange, but you should know something about the pressure inside these blood vessels. And pressure works a lot by diffusion. How, under what kind of circumstances will a molecule move by diffusion? What's the overall driving force for diffusion? High to low what?
High
concentration. Yeah, it's a concentration gradient. It's going to go from high concentration to low concentration. The same thing for a fluid. A fluid will move according to a pressure gradient. And guess how it moves in a pressure gradient? Just like diffusion. Going to go from high pressure to low pressure, right? And so it's the job of the heart to pressurize blood to force it through the cardiovascular system. So where do you, what vessels have the highest pressure? Vessels have the highest pressure. Yeah, like arteries, for instance. What vessels have the lowest pressure? All right, I like what you said, but not how you said it. Because you said veins? No, you have to tell me, not ask me. Okay? Veins. Right? Well, a lot of students in your position right now would, without thinking, say, oh, a capillary's got the lowest pressure. Okay? Because that's the functional spot in the cardiovascular system for exchange, but that doesn't mean that has the lowest pressure. It just means that there is exchange taking place there. Furthermore, if capillaries had the lowest pressure, where would all the blood flow to? It would flow from an artery to a capillary, but it would also flow from a vein back into a capillary. And then what would happen if all this blood were flowing back into a capillary? Well, we'd explode or something. I don't know what would happen, but our blood wouldn't flow through the circulatory system. Right? So where does the lowest pressure have to be to get blood flowing through the circulatory system?
The heart.
Right at the right atrium, or you could say a vein. The lowest pressure in a blood vessel are the veins, in particular the very largest veins nearest the heart, because that's what's drawing blood back to the heart. Okay, because fluid will always flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay. So the last thing on this slide right here is the lymphatic system. The lymphatic system is a vascular system as well. It contains other lymphatic tissues, but part of it is a vascular system, kind of like your circulatory system, and it picks up excess tissue fluid from tissues and delivers it back to the circulatory system. So I don't know how many slides I got in the lymphatic system, but it's probably important to talk a little bit about it. So here is the heart. What is this vessel right here? This is an artery, right? Because it's leaving the heart and this is coming back. What's that? That's a vein right there. Okay, well, these capillaries are very leaky. Every single day at the proximal end of this capillary bed, what's this end over here called? That's a distal end. So at the proximal end, there's about 30 liters of fluid that leave all your capillaries every single day. So how many, is that a large volume or kind of a negligible volume? Well, like a big Coke bottle, how many liters is that? That's 2 liters, so this is 10 times, that's actually what, 15 times as much as one Coke bottle like that. So that's a huge amount of fluid. All right, so and this fluid is going to flow around all the cells, bringing nutrients and helping gas exchange in these cells. All right, and then on the distal end of this capillary, some of it's going to be resorbed. But not all of it gets resorbed just because of the physical chemistry involved. Only 27 liters gets resorbed every day. So what does that mean? What happens to this tissue right here, all these tissues? They pick up excess fluid every single day. As a matter of fact, how much? 1.5 of those Coke bottles, right? So 3 liters, right? And so that extra 3 liters finds its way into the lymphatic system. And the lymphatic vessels take that tissue fluid back to a subclavian vein. Point to where your subclavian vein is. Good. Not everybody knows. No, that would be an ulnar. Subclavian. What that means? That means what? Underneath the clavicle. Yeah, back up over here. So it returns that fluid to your cardiovascular system, because if you were to lose that fluid, what would happen to you? Okay, if it stayed in your tissues, you'd get bigger by a Coke and 2 Coke bottles every day. And again, eventually you'd explode. Okay, so I'm sort of kidding about that explosion part. Okay, but nonetheless, if you lost that fluid, okay, somehow you would dehydrate. So that returns it back to the cardiovascular system, the lymphatic system. Okay, and as the lymph is flowing back to the subclavian vein, it has to pass through at least one lymph node. The lymph node filters lymph, removes pathogens, maybe cancerous cells, other kinds of debris that's in lymph, and that helps fight infection in your body. Okay, so it's returning that tissue fluid, excess fluid, filtered out of capillary beds. Any questions on that? Well, what happens if you have, just to kind of see if you're following what I'm saying right there, what happens if somebody has a certain kind of cancer in a certain part of their body? One of the places where they look to see if cancer has metastasized or moved out of that primary site is to look at some lymph nodes. Okay, and if cancer's in those lymph nodes, what do they have to do? Remove a whole bunch of lymph nodes, including the lymphatic vessels. What do you think, do you think there's any side effects to removing those lymphatic vessels and those lymph nodes? What might be some of the side effects? What's one of the primary functions of the lymphatic system? your immune system might be depressed a little bit, but we just got done talking about what? Excess fluid. So if you remove those vessels from that part of the body, what happens to that part of the body? It swells up. That's right. It becomes edematous, right? There's an edema that is formed in that area. Okay, so it swells up. But that's your choice. Is it easier to live with edema or a fatal cancer? Okay, well, you don't really have much of a choice, right? Okay. All right, so that's just a side effect of that particular procedure. Okay, let's talk about blood for a little bit. Blood has two components to it, two major components. There is the fluid part, and then there's the formed elements part. And the fluid part is what we call plasma, and the formed elements are made up of cells. So cells are floating in the fluid, which we call plasma. And if we were to take blood out of somebody, like right out of their arm, out of a vein in their arm, we would get a product that we call whole blood. So whole blood has plasma plus formed elements all dissolved together. And it would look something like this. So let's talk about formed elements first. Formed elements is the cellular part. We got different kinds of cells. We've got red blood cells that we see right here. They're red because they're filled with hemoglobin. It's a bright red compound when oxygen is bound to it. And hemoglobin carries oxygen to our tissues. That's the function of a red blood cell. What's another name for a red blood cell? Erythrocyte. Erythro means red. Red blood cells are packed with hemoglobin. They don't have room for organelles. There are no organelles, not even a nucleus. So when a red blood cell is challenged by some kind of chemical challenge or whatever, it can't respond anymore. So it has a very limited lifespan. Does anybody know how long a red blood cell lives for? Okay. It lasts for about 120 days, and then it dies. Okay. All right, so that's a red blood cell and the function. These other cells that don't look red, these are what we call white blood cells. These fight infections. So basically that's what all white blood cells do. But there are a number of different kinds of white blood cells. They have a little bit different kind of function, and I think I have a slide on what they do. I'll talk about that in a second, just a little bit. And then the third kind, what do we call white blood cells? What's a scientific name? Leukocytes, because leuko means white. And then the third kind of formed element are platelets. And platelets are important not in carrying oxygen, not in immune response, but in forming blood clots, preventing blood loss. And preventing blood loss is called hemostasis. Hemostasis is maintaining your blood volume. Okay, so those are the formed elements in plasma. Plasma, on the other hand, is mostly made out of water. But it has some things dissolved in water. It's got proteins. I've got a list of some proteins that are in water. Plus maybe a little CO2 and ions like calcium, sodium chloride, magnesium, electrolytes. And what's a nutrient that you can find in blood, dissolved in blood? I'm going to pick on you because you came in late. What's a good nutrient that you find in plasma? Oh, both of you came in late. Okay, well, you can consult each other real quick. Yes, glucose. Okay, you get an extra credit point. That's perfect. Perfect, perfect. Glucose. Yeah, I know it's unfair. Life is terribly unfair, and I'm the best at being unfair. Okay, so don't forget, that's dissolved in the plasma right here. So a lot of times we would like to find out if somebody has a normal number of red blood cells or an abnormal number of red blood cells. All right, if somebody has an abnormally low number of red blood cells, what do we call that? Anemia. Yeah, that's just anemia. So one way that we do this is we take a blood sample, put it in a test tube. Okay, extra credit point. Put it in a test tube and let the test tube sit overnight, and all the heavy stuff is going to sink to the bottom of the test tube, and all the lighter material is going to float to the top. All right, so the plasma is the lighter stuff that floats to the top. All the red blood cells, white blood cells sink to the bottom. And then we can measure the percentage of red blood cells that make up the whole sample of blood that we've drawn. So if you look at this test tube right here, what does this percentage look like compared to the whole volume? Is it 50%?
No.
Obviously, not quite. maybe close, 40-something, right, a little bit more than 30, looks like more than 30%, but 40-something. So in women, it's about 45%. In males, it's a little bit higher, maybe 47, 48%. Okay, and this percentage right here of formed elements in whole blood is what we call hematocrit. All right, but we don't usually have to wait overnight to find out what the hematocrit is, because we can take this whole blood sample and put it in a centrifuge and spin it down, and within a minute be able to make this measurement, okay, of what a hematocrit is. So anybody have a question on how you would measure this hematocrit? Just a percentage of red blood cells in particular in a sample of whole blood. And you can see that's about 40% or so. Okay, I think I talked to everything about this slide already. Okay, now I didn't say much about plasma proteins yet, but these are all soluble proteins. These are dissolved in plasma. Good evening. These are all dissolved in plasma, and proteins comprise almost 10% of plasma. Not percent of your blood, but of your plasma. So if you were to separate the plasma, almost 10% are proteins. And we got three basic kinds. I think I'm going to start down here at the bottom. Fibrinogen is an important kind of protein, and your blood has a lot of it. And when you see a name of a chemical compound with ogen as a suffix, what does that mean? It's a precursor, and also it's inactive, right? So fibrinogen is inactive, but it's ready to do a job at a moment's notice. And it can be converted into fibrin very, very quickly, right? And fibrin is an important protein that's necessary to form a blood clot. We're going to talk about that when we come up. So fibrinogen is able to produce blood clots at a moment's notice. So when you cut yourself, your body doesn't have to build, right, billions of molecules of fibrinogen, because how long might that take? That might take a week. Well, what's going to happen in a week if you have a cut? Well, you might bleed to death, right? So your body builds this precursor ready to go to work at a moment's notice. Okay. Another kind are globulins. Globulins are different proteins that can carry lipids around. Remember, lipids can't dissolve in plasma because plasma is water. Lipids are hydrophobic. So they need like little detergent molecules to help them dissolve in water. That's what some globulins do. So steroid hormones are transported via globulins. And there are other kinds of globulins called gamma globulins, and these form antibodies. We're going to talk about antibodies today. So remember that it's so what part of the blood do you find antibodies? That's probably important to know. What are the two major components of blood? Plasma and formed elements, plasma and formed elements. And where do you find antibodies? In the plasma. Yeah, in the plasma. So we're going to look at that a number of different times, so I want you to make that connection. Antibodies are found in the plasma. You'll see why that makes sense in a little bit. All right, the third class of proteins are what we call albumins, and this accounts for most of the proteins that are dissolved in your plasma, floating around through your circulatory system. And this creates what we call a colloid osmotic pressure that draws water from interstitial spaces back into the capillaries. And we sort of talked about that already. All right, at the proximal end of this capillary, there is high pressure. And that pressure is forcing plasma out of the capillary. And then the pressure decreases as you get to the distal end of the capillary. So when the pressure decreases, right, the pressure gradient reverses a little bit, and some of that tissue fluid gets soaked back into the capillary. All right, but you also know another mechanism. Let me draw it over here. So let's just say this is tissue space, and here is a capillary, and this is the distal end of a capillary. All right, so this is the end of a capillary. And let's just say that we have 5% albumin over here. And let's just say maybe we only have maybe 1% like salt over here in the tissue space. What's the concentration of water in the capillary? What's the concentration of water right here?
95%.
What's the concentration of water over here in the tissue space? 99%. All right, and water can go across this capillary wall, no problem. Is water going to want to diffuse one way or the other? How's it going to want to go? From high to low. What's higher, 99 or 95? 99, so water is going to move from the tissue space back into the capillary. And so what produces this osmotic pressure is the albumin. And albumins are made by the liver, so when somebody has terrible liver disease that is not producing these albumins, what's one of the things that happens to them? They stop resorbing water, right? They get very puffy, okay, as a result of that. Right? They have excess fluid in their tissue spaces because it can't move across the capillary at the distal end of the capillary. So that's what this means right here. Does that sort of make sense? Yeah, you're familiar with those. That process. Okay. Let me say one last thing. Fibrinogen is soluble in water. It dissolves right in, like a sugar cube, if you put that in coffee. Fibrin, on the other hand, right, the active form, that is not soluble. What do we call something? What happens to something when it goes from a soluble form to an insoluble form? What do we call? There's a term for that. As a matter of fact, that's what we call precipitation, right? Precipitation. When something goes to a soluble form and then it falls out of solution and it becomes a solid. So fibrin is actually a solid kind of molecule that precipitates out of blood when it's converted from fibrinogen to fibrin. Okay, I'm going to use that term precipitation when we get to blood clotting. Okay, so serum right here. Plasma. Okay. What the heck is serum? So I'm going to erase this model of the cardiovascular system. One way to think of plasma is that it does have clotting factors. Plasma is equal to, for instance, water plus other kinds of solutes like fibrinogen, glucose, other ions, plus clotting factors. Okay, so clotting factors are an important part of plasma. Give me the name of one clotting factor. Fibrinogen. Okay. So what can we do? We can take plasma and remove the clotting factors from it. So plasma minus clotting factors equals something. Plasma minus clotting factors is what we call serum. So serum is a lot like plasma, except what? It can't clot because it doesn't have any clotting factors in it. It doesn't have any formed elements. It's just a clear, pale, yellow fluid that doesn't have any clotting factors in it. But what can it have in it? It can have antibodies in there. So it can be very protective for other people if you inject it into them. And in that particular circumstance, if we administer antibodies into somebody to help protect their body from infection or a venom, or something, we don't really call that a serum, we would call that an anti-serum, okay, because it contains antibodies. So that's where that term anti-serum came from. Okay, so erythrocytes, leukocytes, are part of formed elements. You can see that there's five different kinds of leukocytes right here, basically one kind of erythrocyte. And each erythrocyte carries 280 million hemoglobins. So that's a lot of oxygen. And because they live such a short period of time, your body has to make 300 billion red blood cells every day. Okay, so that seems like an awfully big number. I see some people shaking their head in disbelief because that's as big as the deficit. that we have, and that's how much money we're giving away to everybody every day. Anybody get any of that money given out? No. What money by Congress? By for huh? It's all for the banks. Okay, well, maybe they'll lend it to us someday. Okay, so it's a really big number. So let's break that down. You could break your calculator out. I could ask you, how many red blood cells die in your body every second? Instead of every day, but every second. All right? And I'll tell you the answer because I don't see anybody's calculator out. It's between 2 and 3 million red blood cells die every second. So that's a huge number. So how many red blood cells does your body have to make every second? Yeah, it has to be in balance, right? It has to be 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second. And if your body doesn't make 2 to 3 million every second, what do we call that condition?
Anemia.
That's anemia, another point. All right, that produces anemia. So your body is tremendously busy doing lots of things, including producing red blood cells every second, highly metabolic organism. What kind of tissue makes red blood cells? It's in bone marrow. Yeah, and in particular, red bone marrow. Right, red bone marrow makes red blood cells. Okay, don't forget these red blood cells don't contain any nuclei and no organelles. That's why they have such a short lifespan. Leukocytes, on the other hand, help fight infection. We got a couple of different kinds. I'm not going to ask you to know leukocytes by their granularity. Sometimes they're broken down into agranular and granular kinds of leukocytes. I just want you to know that all of them fight infection, especially neutrophils, lymphocytes, and monocytes. And eosinophils and basophils are important in the production of inflammatory response, okay, but that helps fight infection as well. Neutrophils are the most common. These are first to arrive at a site of infection, and usually you have millions of these cells accumulating at a site of infection. That's what forms pus, and that's why it kind of looks white, because they kind of look white. Right? Lymphocytes. Probably the second most common form of white blood cell. And again, you can see nuclei in all of these white blood cells right here. These are important because they fight infection. Certain kinds of lymphocytes make antibodies. Other kinds of lymphocytes turn into contact killers. So the kinds that make antibodies are called B lymphocytes. I don't think I have... I'll write that on the board. All right, so B lymphocytes. Make antibodies. And T lymphocytes become contact killers. All right, so when a B lymphocyte bumps into a virus or a bacteria, it identifies that bacteria by markers that are on the cell surface of that bacterium. We call that an antigen. And the B lymphocyte learns to recognize that antigen, and it produces an antibody that can bind to that antigen, and it will lyse the cell. It will break the cell apart. And what happens to the cell when it's broken apart? Well, then it's dead. Right, so it fights that infection. Okay, but so B lymphocytes eventually make antibodies. T lymphocytes, on the other hand, okay, the way that they kill bacteria is that when they actually have to contact the bacteria, bind to an antigen that's on the surface of that bacterium, and then the cell lyses because of chemicals that the T lymphocytes secrete. So both of these can help fight infection. Two different methods. Where do you find antibodies again? In the plasma. Yeah, they're found in the plasma. Okay. So these are called B lymphocytes, probably because of these antibodies. There's a nice B in antibody. There's a B in B lymphocyte. And T lymphocytes go and develop their immune fighting response in the thymus gland. And so that's why we call these T lymphocytes, because they mature in the thymus gland, which is in the mediastinum. Another way to remember that is that they're contact killers, and look at all these nice T's in contact. All right, contact killers. So sometimes we say that the immunity that B lymphocytes provide for is antibody immunity, and lymphocytes provide for cell, I left out a word right here, mediated immunity, and T lymphocytes produce what? Cell mediated immunity. So those two different kinds of lymphocytes, and they all are in the blood. Another important kind of leukocyte that's important for fighting infection is a monocyte. This is a very large cell, but it's a shapeshifter. It can crawl around your body like an amoeba. It can crawl between cells that make up a capillary through your tissue spaces and in all the alveoli in your lungs. You probably have a couple macrophages crawling around in there right now looking for dust particles, bacteria, things like that. And instead of producing antibodies or just touching it and killing it, it will actually surround the bacteria and put it inside a vesicle inside the cell. Okay, and then it might lyse it. So what's that process for moving some particulate matter inside the cell? That's phagocytosis. So monocytes work by phagocytosis. And when a monocyte leaves the circulatory system, we give it a different name. We call it a macrophage. Okay, so and what does macrophage mean? Just big eater, right? Because this is a big cell and it kills pathogens by phagocytosis. And monocytes are also involved in teaching lymphocytes how to identify pathogens that are inside your body too. Okay. All right. So that's probably good for leukocytes. Okay, another name for a platelet is a thrombocyte. They live only for about 10 days, maximally. They're important for maintaining hemostasis. That's all you have to know about that. Okay. All right, the term hematopoiesis refers to the production of red blood cells. All right, so should red blood cell production be regulated in your body? Yeah, just like your blood pressure, just like any other kind of parameter. Blood glucose levels should be regulated, right? And there is a hormone that stimulates, that stimulates the production of red blood cells. So we call that erythropoiesis, is the production of a red blood cell. And what's the tissue again that produces red blood cells? That is red bone marrow. So the hormone that stimulates that stimulates red bone marrow into producing red blood cells is called erythropoietin. Go ahead, say that. Yeah, erythropoietin. That's not too bad. Erythropoietin. And erythropoietin comes from the kidney. So the kidney helps regulate the production of red blood cells. And the kidney is able to monitor oxygen concentration in the blood. And as the percentage of red blood cell declines, what happens to oxygen concentration in the blood? As red blood cells go down, so does oxygen concentration. Okay? So as oxygen concentration goes down, the kidney can sense that, and it's going to secrete erythropoietin in the blood, so that's a hormone. Erythropoietin goes to what target tissue? Red bone marrow, and it stimulates erythropoiesis. Okay, and as red blood cells increase in number because erythropoiesis is stimulated, what happens to oxygen concentration? It increases, all right, and so that's the response. What was the stimulus? The stimulus was decreasing oxygen. The response is increasing oxygen, right? So what do we call that kind of feedback where the response subtracts from the stimulus? That's negative feedback. So this is a nice negative feedback loop that maintains homeostasis. Okay. So I'd be happy, there's probably a figure in your book that I don't have that shows this negative feedback mechanism. Okay, but it involves the kidney, erythropoietin. Right, and leukopoiesis is the formation of white blood cells that's stimulated by various kinds of cytokines or leukopoietin that helps stimulate the immune system when you have an infection, for instance. Okay. I think I talked about all this already, except that, oh, there's something I didn't talk about on here. Okay. So this is just a production. I'm not going to ask you to know the various cell stages that the stem cell has to go through to produce a red blood cell. You should just know that it's devoid of organelles, all right? And when it dies, that releases, what, about 280 million molecules of what into the blood? Okay, hemoglobin in particular. Okay, hemoglobin. So there's 280 million molecules in hemoglobin in each one of these red blood cells that your body has to deal with. And it's the liver and the spleen that helps get rid of those compounds. You can't let it build up in your body. So what is the important compound that carries oxygen in an RBC again? Hemoglobin is what I'm looking for. So hemoglobin, you have to break that down to detoxify it. When you break hemoglobin down, you get two chemicals. You get globin. What does a globin look like? It's a protein. What's a building block of protein? Amino acids. And what can your body do with amino acids? It can make any kind of protein it wants to, right? So that's nice, easy, that's a perfect recycling mechanism. Okay, so globin, when it's broken down, your body can make all kinds of other protein, any kind of protein that needs those amino acids. All right, the heme, okay, oh, so when the hemoglobin is broken down, it produces heme, which is a very large, it's red because it contains iron, it's a very large organic molecule. It's neither lipid nor carbohydrate or protein, it's just a huge organic molecule, and it has to be detoxified. It's also carrying iron. So when heme is broken down, it's broken down into two different components. It's broken down into iron, which your body will use again to make what? More hemoglobin, right? So, and the liver can actually store iron, right? So that iron won't be wasted. And the other part, the part that was holding on to this iron element right here, is broken down into biliverdin, which is relatively toxic, and then that is converted into bilirubin. Okay? And your body excretes bilirubin. Your liver does. It puts it into the bile, and then bile is transported to the intestinal tract. Okay? And then you can lose that in the feces. Now, what kind of color is bilirubin? It's a pigment as well. It's yellow. Right, so when you have, and so that produces that condition called jaundice, when you have elevated levels of bilirubin in your body. And that could be due to a couple things. It could be due to excessive breakdown or lysis of red blood cells. When your body is lysing so many red blood cells, your liver can't process it fast enough. That's the case in newborns, but it could also be due to liver damage. When the liver is not operating properly, this bilirubin can build up in the body. It's not secreted into the bile, and that produces jaundice. And I don't know if anybody has ever seen anybody with jaundice, but it's pretty amazing condition. The whites of your eyes are yellow. Your fingernails are yellow, right? And, skin can be yellow, yeah. And so it could be liver damage or something is attacking your red blood cells. And the newborn can be damaged, or can be jaundiced, because sometimes a mother's own immune system can be attacking the fetus's red blood cells and destroying them, and so then this fetus has this huge burden of bilirubin, and that's a neurotoxin. We'd certainly like to know about it before that condition happens, and a baby can be born jaundiced, but hopefully the treatment after that would be very successful and prevent any further damage to the nervous system. Okay. What is that score when a baby is just born? They're analyzed. Yeah, they're analyzed to see what kind of deficits or how healthy they are, and that's an APGAR score. right? And so the color, if their jaundice goes into that score, their respiratory rate, different kinds of reflexes go into developing the score. What else goes into an APGAR? Reflexes, yeah, reflexes, color, probably respiratory rate, and I forget. I don't know if blood pressure is in there or not. Probably not. Okay, but respiratory rate certainly is. Okay, and some other things too. We could look that up real quick. Yeah, I think it's like 1 to 5 or something. Yeah. 5. Huh? Oh, how many fingers and toes? Oh, they count. See, it's good to take some math classes. Okay. All right, so that's the importance of breaking down hemoglobin. So make sure you know the breakdown products, but that's easy to follow, right? Hemoglobin breaks down to heme and globin. Globin is just a protein. Okay. Okay, well, next topic. Let's see if I can mute this thing. Has to do with transfusion reactions. I don't know what to do with that. Transfusion reactions, and that has to do with blood type. Ah, now you can't see it. Okay. Hopefully I won't start on fire, so watch that for me. Since you're sitting right there. All right, so say you got into a bad accident on the way home, and you started to hemorrhage, and you run into emergency room, you find your way to emergency room, and you say, oh, you know, I work in a hospital, I'm really educated, I'm a healthcare professional, I know what blood type I am, I need a transfusion, type AB. Is somebody going to give you that transfusion in that hospital?
No.
No. They can't take the chance that you might not know what you're talking about, because if they transfuse the wrong kind of blood into you, what's going to happen? You're going to die. That's right. So you're going to get a transfusion reaction, and so we got to know something about a transfusion reaction. It is based on different kinds of systems, and one of the systems is the ABO system. And we can define blood types in the ABO system based on the antigens and antibodies that a person has. Right, so where are we going to find antibodies in somebody? In plasma, that's right, in the plasma. Okay, now I didn't tell you where we find antigens, only kind of maybe in a roundabout way did I say where we found antigens, but anybody garner, get any idea where we find antigens in your body? Okay, they're going to be, have to do with red blood cells, but they're on the, okay. Those are antibodies. Yeah, the globulins are antibodies. On the surface of red blood cells. On the surface of a red blood cell. Okay, so here we have, oh, what's this right here? That's a red blood cell. And on the surface of a red blood cell, so a bunch of investigators started looking at, trying to figure out what was going on with these transfusion reactions, so they started looking at various things that were on the surface of a red blood cell, and they found something that would produce a transfusion reaction. So guess what they called it?
Marker.
Okay, it's a marker. So it was the first marker they found. So they thought, well, we could call it number one, but let's call it A. Okay? So they found a marker on the cell membrane that had a particular shape that always interacted with an antibody, and it was the first one they found, so they said, well, let's just call it A over here. Okay, so these are antigens. So antigens are on the surface of a cell, and they're experimenting and messing around, and then they found another one. Guess what they call that? B. All right, so here's another one. Now, A has a different shape than B, right? It's not that these markers actually have the shape of an A or shape of a B. They're just different, right? And every A has the same shape. Every B has the same shape. And then they're experimenting, and they found a red blood cell, right, that didn't have A or B on it. So what are they going to call this one? Well, they call it zero, okay? But could you have A, B, and zero? Is kind of incongruent. So then somebody had a bright idea and said, oh, I know what we can call it.
Oh.
So this is blood type O. Okay. All right, so these are what? Antigens or antibodies? antigens. That's right, antigens. So antigens you find on the surface of the plasma membrane of red blood cells. And where are antibodies located? In the plasma, not on the surface. All right, so the blood type that a person is defined by the antigens that they have. This is, I think, how you should approach learning that. Right, so the blood type that somebody is by the antigens on their cell surface. So here I see a red blood cell that has both A and B antigens. So what's the blood type of a person that's producing this cell right here? That's AB. It's in the ABO system. There might be other qualifiers that we want to say about transfusion reactions, but in the ABO system, it would just be AB. And what would be the blood type of this person? Oh, because there are no antigens. What would be the blood type of this person here? Yeah, just B. Okay, and if it was just A, that would be blood type A. Okay. All right, now what does an antibody look like? You have it in your slides, but I'm going to draw it out for you. An antibody kind of looks like a little man running around in your blood, right? It's got a couple little legs right here with some arms sticking out. Okay, and we're not going to really learn all the different parts of an antibody. And here are some hands up over here that have receptor sites on them. Okay, and they have a particular shape because they will bind a certain shape of an antigen. So what kind of antigen can this antibody bind to? What does it look like? It looks like a B. So this is a B antibody, or you could just as well say anti-B. Right, so here is anti-B. Like that. Because this antibody, it's not big like that, the scale is all wrong. Okay, what can that antibody do? It can come over here, right, and bind to this B antigen, and what could it do over here? Here's an AB, right, here's an AB blood cell. So here's another B. Did I do, oh, I did that really wrong. It's more like this. So this antibody can join this red blood cell and this one together because this one binds to this receptor site, number two binds to the second receptor site. But you have millions of antibodies in the blood, so what millions of cells will be joined together, will clump together, and when all these red blood cells clump together, they will lyse. Right? They will swell, they'll blow up and release all that hemoglobin, and it's going to kill these cells, of course. Right? So a transfusion reaction is going to cause that clumping of blood together because the antibodies will join all these millions of cells together. And the name of that process, you got to know. A transfusion reaction is produced by a process called agglutination. That's agglutination, right? Which is different than what we were talking about in terms of clotting. So the best way to understand agglutination is what kind of reaction is it? Agglutination is an antigen antibody reaction, right? It's an antibody antigen reaction. Where do you find antibodies again? Plasma, where do you find antigens? On the cell surface. So on your test, I'm probably going to give you some cells and you have to tell me what kind of blood type it is. Easy to do, right? It all depends on what? The antigen that's on the surface of the cell. So it's actually pretty easy if you see that. But there's a little table that you could generate to help you understand this. I don't know, you probably have a table that's similar to this in your book. Okay? You could have, how many different blood types are there? Okay, go ahead, tell me what they are. A, I like A. B, I like B. AB, I like AB. And O. So how many is that?
Four.
That's four. Okay, so you got four different blood types. And so forget about this little guy right here. That's not neither here nor there. All right, so in agglutination, what are we concerned with? Antibody. And what else? Antigen. Antigen. Right here. Where do we find antibodies? plasma, so I'm just making some little waves right here to say what liquid. And antigens are found on the surface of red blood cells, so I'll just make a little red blood cell. And then we're going to make a table like this. Okay, so somebody with type A blood, what do you automatically start to think of? What defines type A blood? A antigen. So we're going to say, sure, it's got an A antigen. Well, how about if we say what? I'll put an A right here. It's got antigen A on the surface of the red blood cell. Now, what about the antibody? I haven't told you about that. Okay. A person will automatically make antibodies for antigens that they don't have on the surface of their red blood cells. So somebody with blood type A is going to make, I'm going to abbreviate it, anti-B. All right, so what about a person with B type blood? They have a B antigen on the surface of red blood cells. What kind of antibodies do they make? Anti-A. So far, so good. So you see how easy that is to generate? Now, what about a person with AB blood type? Always start with the antigen. What do they got? They got A plus B, right? So I'll say both A and B. Now, what about antibodies? They better not have any, because otherwise it's going to cause agglutination, right? So neither. Neither A, right, nor B. And then blood type O is what? What kind of antigens? Always start with the antigen. Where do you find the antigen again?
Cell
surface. Right. And what kind of antigens does somebody with blood type O have? Neither. Right? So none. No antigens. But what about antibodies? It's going to have both. Both anti-A and B. Okay, so that's what you have to know about the ABO system. Okay. The screen. So what kind of process is agglutination?
Antibody.
Yeah, it's an antibody-antigen reaction. Exactly. Then you got to know where those antigens are located. Cell surface, antibodies are in the plasma, just like one of those previous other slides. So here you can see what an antibody looks like. And how do you explain the binding of an antibody to an antigen? What model would you like to have in your mind? Like lock and key, perfect example. Yeah, just say lock and key. Okay, and that's agglutination. This is what a transfusion reaction looks like. Did you do that with fake blood in here at the beginning of the semester? See what it looked like? No, but you can see the clumping of red blood cells right here. It just kind of, another way you could say that, it precipitates the red blood cells out. It just clumps them all together, and then they actually explode. They lyse. Okay. All right, so type O is what we call universal donor because it lacks A and B antigens. So you can give that blood to people and it will never agglutinate. Even if there are antibody A or antibody B in the recipient, it won't agglutinate that blood. Type AB is what we call universal recipient because it doesn't make anti-A or anti-B antibodies. And when you put these into the circulatory system, it dilutes out what's in the recipient's blood, so it doesn't cause massive amounts of agglutination. But you know what? In everyday life, you never give the wrong kind of blood to somebody, even if somebody's a universal donor or recipient, right? I mean, unless you're in a war zone and it's the only blood you have available for days and days and days, you might do something like that. But in real life, you would never do something like that at all. As a matter of fact, you would pay attention to other blood group systems, other antibody antigen systems besides the ABO. And there's one more that we're going to talk about in here, okay? And that's the Rh factor. Okay, so when you get a blood type, commonly you're given what, A, B, O, like O, plus something else. What's the something else? Like either positive or negative. And the Rh system is actually a little bit simpler to appreciate, okay, because in this case, you either have the Rh antigen or you don't. So What does that look like? So I'm going to erase this cheat sheet right here. So the reason why they call it RH factor is because it was first discovered in an animal model, an animal that they were researching, and that was a rhesus monkey. All right, so that's where the RH thing came from, but we still have that same kind of antigen on our red blood cells. All right, so you can have RH antigen or no RH antigen. And where do you find the antigens again? Surface of a red blood cell. So if you have the RH antigen, that's plus. If you don't have it, it's minus. Right? Just simple as that. So what kind of blood type is this person right here in terms of the ABO system and the RH system? What would you call this? This is O. I like O because I don't see AB. O. I hear some positive. I hear some negative. Okay, but I don't see an RH antigen anywhere. Do you see an RH antigen anywhere? So if there's no antigen, it is minus. So this is an O minus individual. All right, so what would be the blood type of this person here? That's an A. A what? A negative. All right, what would be the blood type of this person right here? That would be AB positive. All right, so make sure you can look at these cell types on your test and tell me what kind of blood type it is. Now, in the ABO system, if you're a blood type A, your body automatically, and from a very early age, makes anti-B and sticks it in the plasma. If you're a B type person, your body automatically makes anti-A, antibody A, and puts it in your plasma, right? But the RH factor is a lot different, right? If you're an RH negative person, like what I had drawn right here, let's say here's a RH negative, you might expect, or what could your body produce and stick in the plasma and for you wouldn't cause any problems? What's compatible with a RH negative person? You could put, like the A person could have anti-B in their blood, no problem. And an RH negative person could have what kind of antibody in their blood? Anti-RH, because it's not going to agglutinate these cells, right? But this anti-RH is not produced in people unless they're stimulated into producing it. So they have to have a transfusion, okay, that puts RH positive blood into their body. Or there's another circumstance. The other circumstance is where you have a person inside of another person. Okay? Where, how would that be? Like pregnancy or gestation. Okay? So there can be an abnormal condition develop, a pathological condition develop, for instance, if you have a mom who is RH negative, but have a baby, now, how about a fetus, right, that is RH positive. How can that happen? Because you do a mom cross dad, right, and mom is negative and dad is positive, it's going to be a 50-50 chance what the baby's going to be. Baby could be 50% of the time negative, 50% of the time positive, okay? So now you have these antigens, right, inside the mom, and the first pregnancy there's usually no difficulty because the mom is not presensitized. The mom mom's immune system doesn't know what the RH factor looks like, has no idea. Okay? Pregnancy goes normal to term, parturition takes place, what happens? Mixing of fetal circulation and maternal circulation during parturition, right, when the placenta is removed. So now the fetus, okay, put some of this RH antigen into the mom, and now what does the mom's body do? The mom produces anti-RH. So now, for subsequent pregnancies, if the fetus is RH positive, the mother can recognize that antigen and will produce, and these antibodies can go across the placenta and attack the fetal blood cells because they have the Rh antigen. And those red blood cells are going to agglutinate, they're going to lyse, and this baby has this burden of bilirubin, they're born jaundiced. Okay, so we would certainly like to prevent that condition. That condition is called erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn. So hemolytic disease of the newborn can happen when the mom is Rh negative and the dad is Rh positive, not in the first pregnancy, but during the second. But nonetheless, we certainly would like to know that, okay, the blood types, and that's why you had to get blood testing before you got married a long time ago. Okay, now it's treated so easily, but with proper prenatal care, we're aware that this condition can develop, and this kind of reaction can be prevented by getting immunoglobulins to prevent that condition from developing even in the first time. So it's even treated during the first pregnancy so the mom doesn't get as sensitized to that Rh factor. Okay, so that is a different system. Right, so be able to identify a blood type of somebody if I give you their red blood cell. What are you going to look for on the surface of a red blood cell? Their antigens. So what do we call that antibody antigen reaction? That is agglutination, right? That's agglutination. All right, let's go to another topic. Oh, good, we got a half hour left. Okay. Hemostasis, okay, is the cessation of bleeding when you damage a blood vessel. Right, and there are two general kinds. If there's very minor damage to a blood vessel, that damage can be plugged up by a platelet, an accumulation of platelets. We call that a platelet plug. And I'm not going to spend much time talking about platelet plugs, but it's only for very minor kinds of injuries. When a blood vessel gets damaged, it reveals the connective tissue inside of a blood vessel. The inner lining of a blood vessel is endothelium, which is just an epithelium, doesn't have a lot of connective tissue in it, but the deeper layers of a blood vessel have collagen, and that's going to stimulate these platelets to stick to that area that's been damaged. And the platelets then release chemicals that cause vasoconstriction in that blood vessel, which then have a tendency to anneal or bring that wound together to stop bleeding. But that only happens in very, very small tears, at the level of maybe one cell to two cells or three cells in diameter. All right, so I'm not going to talk about the different kinds of factors involved with platelet plug formation, but you should at least know that there is a role for platelets that we call platelet plug formation for very, very tiny microscopic injuries to blood vessels. Okay, and that's due to platelets coming together. The second kind of process that maintains hemostasis is what we call coagulation. Right, so did everybody hear that coagulation sounds a lot different than agglutination? Right, so we're talking about agglutination first, now coagulation. And coagulation is due to the formation of fibrin. Fibrin is what is going to form a blood clot. Okay, so let's talk about fibrin formation. What the heck is fibrin? There are two pathways in your body that can precipitate fibrinogen from your blood into fibrin. And what fibrin is, right, when it's formed, it forms a net or a mesh or a network of insoluble fibers, and it flows up against a wound or an injury to a blood vessel. So now you have this net over the blood vessel and blood is flowing out of it, but that mesh or network is so small that blood cells can't get through it. So it traps red blood cells, it traps platelets and white blood cells, and eventually that forms a complete seal over that blood vessel, which is what we call a clot. But that has to happen because of fibrin formation. It won't happen without fibrin formation. So we got two pathways, an intrinsic pathway, okay, and extrinsic. All right, so notice that both of these pathways right here require calcium for it to happen. Right, so that's another important reason to have the proper levels of calcium in your body, not just for strong bones. All right, and this is the pathway right here. Here's the extrinsic, the intrinsic pathway and the extrinsic pathway. All right, and the intrinsic pathway is activated by exposure of blood to collagen. Where do you have collagen? Deep inside a blood vessel. Well, right, when a blood vessel gets ripped open, that collagen then can bump into platelets. All right, and actually when we take blood out of somebody and put it in glass, glass has some negative charges on it, and that will also activate the intrinsic pathway. And intrinsic means that this is a property of the blood itself. It doesn't need anything else inside the body that is exterior to the blood, so that's an intrinsic pathway. An extrinsic pathway means that there has to be chemical compounds that are coming from outside the circulatory system. And those chemical compounds have access to the blood when you, what, break a blood vessel open or rip a blood vessel open. So in the extrinsic pathway, we call that chemical thromboplastin. That's in the tissues. That enters the blood and that starts a cascade of effects, which also includes calcium. Okay? And I guess the only thing that you should see in this intrinsic pathway right here, you see a number of different steps. What do we call this scheme right here where you have a number of different steps in it? And what's the purpose of having this multi-step reaction? This is what we call, your book doesn't do a really good job of explaining this, but I mentioned it before, that's what we call a cascade, right? So here's a cascade. So one molecule here can convert many factor 12s, inactive factor 12s, into what, thousands of active factor 12s. And all of these thousands of activated factor 12s can activate these factor 11s, even thousands more, right? So a cascade, each one of these steps is a step of amplification. So blood clotting can happen very quickly in your body to stop blood loss. Okay. All right, so what do I want you to know about this process right here? I want you to know that there are three main important steps. So I don't want you to, this is not an exam figure, but I want you to know three main important steps. And we're going to start with the last step. Oh, I got to block this out. Do I smell like a bonfire? Do you smell smoke in here? Yeah?
Yeah.
Those chemistry students again, probably. Three steps to forming a blood clot. Okay, so what did we call an antibody, a transfusion reaction again, an antibody antigen reaction, what do we call that? Agglutination, all right. But now we're not talking about agglutination, we're talking about coagulation. Totally different thing. So the third step is the conversion of fibrinogen, is that active or inactive? Inactive into fibrin. And what does fibrin look like? It just, it looks like a net that's going to trap everything as things are flowing out of the vascular system. Okay, and your body's making fibrinogen all the time, primarily in the liver, okay? And it can become activated at a moment's notice. Now, what converts fibrinogen to fibrin? You have it on your slide right there, but I'll put it on the board. That's the second most important step, okay? And the thing that works here is something called thrombin. So thrombin is an enzyme that converts fibrinogen to fibrin. And thrombin is not active in your body all the time, only unless you have an insult to a blood vessel. So what do we name something that is held in an inactive form all the time in your body? It can be called a ogen, right, if you put it at the end. But in this particular case, we don't use that. We use a prefix. What's a prefix that we put at the beginning of a term to mean that it's inactive? Pro, right? So we have prothrombin. Your body makes it all the time, keeps it in an inactive form, but it can be converted into thrombin at a moment's notice because it might take weeks to build up enough prothrombin in case you get a cut, and by that time, you would be dead already. Right, so prothrombin is converted to thrombin. That's the second step. So thrombin formation is the second step. The first step, all right, is where all those clotting factors come into play, including some phospholipids and calcium when blood and platelets are exposed to collagen. Okay, it produces something called prothrombin activator. So what does prothrombin activator do? It works here to activate prothrombin, and what does it become? It becomes thrombin. And what does thrombin do? It converts fibrinogen to fibrin, which is that net that's going to cause the clot to form. So all these three steps right here are what we call coagulation, right? That's coagulation. Okay, so a lot of times people are given anticoagulants, or maybe you can even take a household remedy that will decrease your clotting function. Let me put the slide back down. Okay, and in the lay terminology, for the layman, what do they call these things that are anticoagulants or decrease your clotting function? Like if you were to talk to somebody on the street, they wouldn't call them anticoagulants. They would call them blood thinners. Now, is that just ridiculous or what? Okay, I would hopefully say that you can see that that's kind of a ridiculous statement, because it's not changing the viscosity of your blood or the hematocrit, the number of cells you have, or changing anything about the consistency of your blood. It is what? It's just disrupting this process right here. It's preventing the formation of fibrin to some degree. So it's not a blood thinner. It's not thinning out your blood. It's changing the chemistry and the metabolic activity, okay, inside the plasma by altering these different clotting factors. Okay. Well, I'm not going to have you know much about all these different kinds of clotting factors. What, they found one and so they called it? Factor one. Then they found another thing that was important. They call it factor two. So you can look at all these different clotting factors, and of course calcium, that's factor four. So calcium is necessary for blood having proper blood clotting function. Okay. Well, it's probably pretty important, or do you think it's important to be able to regulate your clotting function? Okay. All right. So when you have a real important function in your body, how is it controlled? What kind of control system is used? Is it a tonic control system or an antagonistic control system? Usually antagonistic control system, right? So we just learned a process that produces blood clots, but that means what? There's got to be something that does what? That reverses those effects, that dissolves a blood clot or prevents a clot from forming, right? Because, for instance, if you cut your finger, a paper cut over here, do you want a blood clot in your other finger? No, because chances are blood would be clotting everywhere in your body and you'd be dead. Does anybody know what that's called when you all of a sudden a patient's blood starts to clot everywhere? That's called disseminated intravascular coagulopathy. Really serious condition. Everybody gets really excited in a hurry because usually somebody's almost about ready to die when that happens, right? So you need to prevent that from happening. That means a whole balance of things is disturbed in their blood. But normally, you have an enzyme in your system that is held in an inactive form, namely plasminogen. It can be converted to plasmin, and the job of plasmin is to digest fibrin, to prevent a blood clot from forming. This happens after the wound is healed, okay, but it also limits the extent of a clot formation. Okay, so when damage to a blood vessel is repaired, factor 12, it becomes activated. That activates kallikrein, and kallikrein converts plasminogen to plasmin, and that digests the plasmin clot, and that so that limits the extent of a clot formation. But this is also important clinically. We've used how to manipulate this system clinically, because what can an improper blood clot produce in somebody? A stroke, for instance, when a blood clot goes to the brain, it gets lodged in a blood vessel. That blood vessel is not bringing oxygen to the brain. How long does that section of brain have? 3 seconds before it loses function, and then 3 minutes it dies, right? So you don't have a long time to deal with that. But if it's a blood clot, guess what? We could give somebody something that's going to stimulate plasmin production, and it's going to go pretty much everywhere in the body, including the brain, and do what to that clot? Dissolve it, break it down. And when that happens, what happens to perfusion? That part of the brain reperfuses and hopefully comes back to life, right? As long as the period hasn't been extended too long. Same thing for the heart. When somebody's having a heart attack, sometimes a blood clot lodges in a coronary artery, blocks perfusion to that part of the heart, and that can be reversed like that if somebody is able to be given, right? There are two compounds that we actually use. Streptokinase acts like plasmin, breaks down blood clots. That's from a bacteria. And the other compound, we don't ever really give plasmin, but it's called TPA, tissue plasminogen activator, that activates plasmin that dissolves the blood clot. So that can reverse the effects of a heart attack. That can be life-saving. But if, particularly in terms of a stroke, if you have any family members, right, or even somebody with a heart attack, one of the first things that, if it's kind of a minor episode, people have denial about what's happening to them. And so it will look like a transient ischemic attack. They'll forget who they're with or their surroundings, and it'll be really strange because maybe your mom or dad won't recognize you. Well, that's really serious, right? Don't let them kind of, and don't you ignore that symptom. What should you do? Get them in, yeah, get them into a hospital immediately, because if the insult is very early, it can be treated with these kinds of pharmaceuticals like TPA, and it can erase the effects of a stroke, right? So what's better, having no stroke or having a stroke and then having to go through physical therapy for a year or two learning how to use your hand or how to swallow again, right? I mean, so just preventing the effects of a stroke is just so powerful. So quick treatment, and we live in a major city where the hospitals have this kind of technology available to them. But not every place in the United States has the correct physicians that can diagnose a condition and treat it properly. Right? For instance, strokes can be produced by other kinds of things, not just a blood clot, but a stroke can be produced by a rupture of a blood vessel. Right? So then there'll be bleeding in the brain that's going to kill that part of the brain. Would you want to give TPA or plasmin to somebody that's having a stroke due to bleeding as opposed to a blood clot? Because what will that do? That will make it worse, right? So when somebody's having a stroke, it's got to be diagnosed properly, right? If it's a clot, it can be treated with TPA, but if it's a bleed, no, none of that kind of stuff, right? So probably some, it's going to hemorrhage more. Okay, so don't say blood thinners, say anticoagulants. You want a break? You want a break? Okay, so we're going to start. Okay, we'll start right here with anticoagulants. Yeah, I was just pushing to get to pulmonary and systemic surgery. You do the last slide real quick. Okay, so anticoagulants, there's a number of things that can be used clinically. Something can be used routinely, but not clinically. The thing that's used routinely in test tubes is EDTA. Or sodium citrate, because these are what we call chelators of calcium. They will take calcium out of solution, will bind it up, will eat up calcium, and calcium is an important clotting factor. If you take that out of solution, blood can't clot. So if you take blood out of somebody and you want to analyze it, you want to check it, you don't want it to clot, you want it to remain a fluid, just have some EDTA in that test tube and it won't clot. So when you get your blood drawn, you probably see stuff already in the test tube. And EDTA is one of those things. But you can't inject EDTA into somebody because it's very toxic and it's hard to titrate the right dose. But patients can take heparin or Coumadin, okay? But you got to be careful how much you give, right? Because you don't want this person to bleed out. You want to maintain some clotting function. Heparin activates antithrombin 3. Antithrombin does what? It blocks the formation of thrombin. If you don't have thrombin, then you can't convert fibrinogen to fibrin, and that decreases fibrin formation or clotting function. All right, Coumadin blocks clotting by inhibiting the activation of vitamin K, and vitamin K works indirectly by reducing calcium availability in the blood. All right, so vitamin K you have in your diet. Does anybody know what a good dietary source of vitamin K is? Green leafy vegetables. A good source would be broccoli. Okay, so your diet is going to affect what kind of levels of Coumadin you need. So when somebody's on Coumadin anticoagulation therapy, they have to get their blood measured every once in a while because their diet might vary and the Coumadin level has to be adjusted. But of course, when you're on Coumadin therapy, they tell you, you can eat broccoli, go ahead, but don't have like a ton one day and none the next for a week and then eat a ton again, because the efficiency of that drug is going to vary depending on diet. And that's kind of it. It's like, I have a fun story to tell you about my nephews, though. Okay? They were really, really young. They were young, so they'd like to horse around all the time. And because they horsed around really tough, they would come down with nosebleeds. Because somebody gets thrown into a table or get an elbow in the face or something, right? And so they would come to me and say, oh, Uncle Joe, I have a nosebleed, right? And so I was sort of sympathetic, but I was not really too sympathetic because they would never eat their vegetables at the dinner table, right? So I'd say, finish that broccoli. And they would just kind of look at me like I was crazy. So I would go back, all right, and I would show them this and tell them all about these clotting factors and vitamin K and how important it was, all right, to have proper clotting function. And you think they would listen to me, the little 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds? Okay, they wouldn't listen. These guys would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli. Okay, but you know, they're still alive today, so it's probably okay. But guess what? Now they eat healthily their vitamins, vitamin K, in green leafy vegetables. All right, so that's why when somebody's on Coumadin, you have to be concerned with diet because it does affect their clotting function. Okay? It has to be adjusted all the time. Okay, so that's it for tonight.